Did anybody get to go to, yesterday there was a talk by someone in the medical examiner's office in New York about identifying the World Trade Center victims from DNA evidence. I don't know if anybody, I think I sent around an announcement of that. Did anybody get that? I think we got the announcement. Who has sent it out? Yeah, okay. I don't think I saw anybody there. So you're all equally good or bad. But I had a very, very, very interesting talk because it was, it covered a lot of the issues that we've talked about. It hit on several of the issues that we talked about in class, which is, how, for example, do you do DNA identification? We talked about this early on in the semester. We talked about these tests that, where there are certain highly variable, certain places on the genome where there are highly variable, there are a lot of repeats, okay, and these vary a lot from person to person. And so the way that they would identify it is that they would do PCR, okay, to amplify. We talked about PCR a little bit. That was a way of amplifying DNA sequences. Basically, the sequence between a starting and stopping position. Okay, so you would give a sequence slightly upstream of what you want, a sequence slightly downstream of what you want. PCR would then let you amplify the region in between it. And you could then measure the length of the resulting fragments. And if this is a region in the genome where people have lots of, it's something which is, let's say, in the quote unquote junk DNA, it doesn't really affect survival or anything. But if there's highly variable lengths between these two markers, by measuring the length of, for a particular starting and stopping position, measuring the length of the distance in between gives some clue as to who the person is or is not. And then on the World Trade Center project, basically what they were doing is that they had something like 13 positions on the genome that they were checking. And for each sort of victim sample that they had, they would amplify that region and measure the length of it. And if they got amplification in all those regions, they had enough information to do a pretty reliable identification. But of course, the World Trade Center samples were highly degraded, because some terrible conditions, and so not all the regions amplify or did not. So it's a very difficult problem to try to identify people from at the end.
What was the numerical analysis?
Right. So the question is, it's not just enough to know how many repetitions you have between each loci, but you need to be able to have some reference material to compare it to. So one of the things that they would do is use toothbrush, and they would get victims' families to donate material that might have some sort of biological remains of the person they can identify. So for example, the toothbrush was a very good example. That's about that there were a lot of cheek cells that sort of get rubbed up on your toothbrush. And so comparing the evidence that you had from let's say you had cells you could really identify or link to the person, then this kind of evidence would be enough to identify the genetic sample. And if not, if you had, let's say, genealogical DNA evidence from, let's say, both parents, you could sort of do, that somehow you've got half your markers should be inherited from each parent. So in principle, they can make some identifications if they have enough family members, okay, associated with it. So I thought it was very, very interesting to see sort of how it was being done and how real world situations come in. Again, the fact that the samples are very degraded makes it very hard. There are a lot of things that don't work under these conditions, and they've gone to very impressive lengths to try to identify these remains. One other thing that they were doing was that they were sampling samples they couldn't identify this way. They went through the mitochondrial genomes, mitochondrial DNA of the samples, and they would actually sequence about a 600 base region that was highly variable from person to person. And so by comparing the actual, now they would have a 600 base sequence that should vary a lot from person to person. And based on this sequence of information, you can identify more, you know, other samples that you might not be able to get reproduced, you know, get good evidence for it as well. A very interesting problem. Any other questions? Any questions? Anything at all? Okay. The last class, we've been talking about proteomics. We've been sort of in a unit where we're talking about proteins. And we've been talking about last class, or we were talking about protein folding. Can you reverse the lights? Can you? I think that's better. Okay. So we've been talking about proteins, and what do we know about proteins so far? Well, we know that proteins are defined by these sequences of amino acids, and we know they fold up into shapes, and we know that they do important things in the cell. And one of the things that they do that's extremely important is that proteins turn on and turn off, you know, certain proteins turn on and turn off other genes, okay? And it's somehow proteins have a regulatory role to sort of determine what genes get turned on and what genes get turned off. And the basic idea of how that works, we've discussed probably several times. But in principle, there is a gene to tell you how to make a protein. Upstream, I mean, different types of cells clearly make different amounts of each type of protein. How do we know that? Well, brain cells are different than fat cells, are different than skin cells. So there's something different between these. And we know that cells do different things when they get exposed to different, you know, different elements. If you heat, you know, you take a yeast or a yeast cell and you expose it to heat, it's going to do something different than if it didn't otherwise. So trying to figure out how genes work or how organisms work, you want to know when are the genes turned on and turned off. Okay, and that is basically governed by the upstream region of each gene. Okay? There are typically, a basic vision of the way this works is that there are these binding sites, okay, promoter sites that are upstream of the gene. And some protein binds to these promoter sites, okay? And once these promoter sites, these proteins are bound, then the RNA polymerase that copies the gene, okay, ends up being able to bind better, and that's what sort of kicks off the process. So somehow, a lot of the regulation of genes is a process that you've got these upstream sites which things stick to, and if the right things stick to them, it helps turn on the gene, and if the wrong thing sticks to it, it gums up the process and the gene can't get turned on. And so somehow, this is sort of the regulatory way to do it. You know, one gene is turning on, this gene will make a protein. This protein might later go and turn off other genes, okay, or turn on other genes. So there is sort of this regulatory relation. And somehow what is governing this are these sites where DNA, where proteins are sticking to the upstream region of the DNA. And trying to identify what those sites are is a very, very important problem. Because if you can figure out what they are, you can figure out what is, and that's an important part of trying to figure out what is turning on and off this gene. When is it being turned on and off? What does this gene do? Okay? Any questions? Yeah? Is it not turned off? Is it turned on? My vision of this is not a digital process, okay? So it's not a purely digital process. My sense is that when we talk about these things as promoters, I think of that as being that it sort of helps the system work better, rather than turning it completely on or completely off. You think about it, you're making molecules, and what I think that these things sort of govern is what is the rate. How often, how frequently do you make RNA transcripts of this thing? Okay? And so presumably when you don't have any promoter, nothing is bound to it. Okay? It will continue to make transcripts at a slow rate. Okay? Because somehow the important thing seems to be that this RNA polymerase has to stick to it, has to bind. And maybe it weakly binds and nothing is there. And so something, a wind comes by and you knock it off. Okay, it's not tightly bound. But the more you have a way of supporting promoters, things bound in promoters, the more likely it is that the molecules bind and start the process. Okay? And likewise, I gather if you have an inhibitor, you probably don't shut it down completely. You just gum up the work so that it happens much less often. Okay, so on and off, this is not an analog process. On and off is not on and off. But on and off is, you know, highly expressed and weakly expressed. Any questions? So the critical thing is to try to figure out, or a critical part of this process, is to try to identify what are the these regions where these promoters are binding, where these promoter proteins are binding to. Okay? And in general, these promoter proteins sites are very, very difficult to find. Okay? Gene prediction programs are now pretty good. Okay? People sort of are, in general, I would say reasonably happy with their gene prediction programs. Not that they couldn't be better, but the problem of finding promoter sites is still a very open problem. Okay? And the reason it happens is because promoter sites are tricky business. First of all, the binding sites tend to be very small, something like on the order of 5 to 10 nucleotides. Okay, so you're looking for small sequences. But worse than that, they're not completely conserved. Okay, yes. I am going to say 5 to 10 nucleotides. What my understanding is that the sequence where it's binding is short, something like about 5 to 10 nucleotides. The protein itself may or may not be a large thing, but the part that is actually sticking to it presumably has to be fairly small if it's going to bind to that motif. Okay? So the protein itself is presumably much significantly larger, but so the problems are, first of all, that these patterns that we're looking for, these binding patterns, are short. The other thing is that they are not completely conserved. Okay? So if something, you have a short sequence, and the purpose of this sequence is that a protein is going to stick to it. And the protein, whether something sticks to it, is not not a 0-1 state. Okay? That the better the match between the binding site on the protein and the DNA, the more likely it is to stick. But sometimes other garbage is going to stick there, and it might miss a certain, there might be several bases that are different, and the protein will still stick with some efficiency to it. So these binding motifs are not so strongly conserved.
Okay? And that's what makes them very hard. They're very short, very noisy patterns. Okay? And what we call a motif is basically a very short, noisy pattern. Okay? And what we'd like to do is to analyze a set of sequences. In the cases of finding these binding sites, they're short, noisy patterns. In analyzing protein data, let's say that you have a protein that is a very important protein that is shared between lots and lots of different species. Okay, so it's, the protein basically appears in yeast, it appears in humans, it appears in all kinds of bacteria and everything. There's been so much evolution along the way that the protein has changed its composition quite a bit. Presumably, the important part of the protein, let's say we talk about a binding protein that binds to a promoter. We agree that there was this large protein that was potentially sticking to a very small site. The interesting thing for the protein to do its job, it has to get this part right. And maybe the part where, something else sticks. So it might be that proteins tend to be clustered into families that do similar things. And the sort of characterization of what makes a protein part of a family is often very, very short, noisy features. Maybe it means that you need to have a helix here and a helix there. Okay? And this helix needs to be described by a particular
pattern of amino acids. So identifying these short conserved regions in proteins are also sort of thought of as motifs. Okay? And again, the basic problem is, given a bunch of sequences,
you want to find short, reasonably, but not very strongly conserved regions that are shared by all of them. Okay, and that is the basic problem of motifs and motif finding. Any questions? Yeah.
So it is certainly the case that if you have a short motif, well, again, it is quite reasonable for me to believe that to a particular promoter site, there may be several different proteins that might bind to this thing. So it might be that this gene is turned on if either protein A or protein B or protein C is expressed. And that starts to get into sort of this idea of how gene regulation gets to be fairly complicated. Okay? In this case, what the important thing is will it bind reliably to that site? Okay? And again, so maybe the proteins in a family are all of those that bind reliably to this site. And so there might be a motif on the protein itself that's sort of a thing that's shared that enables it to bind with that. Okay? Any questions? Yeah. Yeah, so presumably some proteins, can turn on some genes and turn off other genes. A lot of proteins turn off are self-inhibited, meaning they turn themselves off. Okay? Why would that be a good thing? Well, let's say you can turn on a gene. It may be that once you've made enough of it, that you have enough concentration in the cell floating around. It might be nice if it's stuck to its promoter site and gums up the work, so it would reduce the efficiency. Okay? So this regulatory machinery is extremely complicated. Okay? But one way to get a handle on it is to try to identify where is it that things bind. Okay? What are these promoter sites? Or what are these motifs, if you wish, of particular promoters, okay, that turn things on and off? Any questions? So one reason why we're identifying once we know these patterns,
it might be interesting. Suppose I know that GATTC is a promoter site. For that things bind to turn it on.
Suppose I have two proteins, two genes in the speak organism, both of which have GAATC above it, upstream of it. Likely, the same promoter protein that turns this on turns this on. So these genes are probably co-regulated. That there's some condition to which both these genes get expressed at the same time. Okay? So that's the kind of thing that once you identify interesting short patterns, you can now make a guess and say, yeah, these two proteins are co-expressed. Okay? Maybe you can study that with microarrays or something like that to confirm it. But it enables you to make predictions or guesses about how this regulatory machinery works. Any questions? But so somehow the problem that we're faced is trying to identify
these short patterns from sequence data. Any questions? Okay, good. So when we talk about these patterns, they're usually described as two different ways that I'm used to hearing motifs described by. Okay? One is we describe them by profiles, okay, which is what I would say a matrix of probabilities, where the rows here represent the possible bases, A, C, G, and T. Let's say this is a DNA motif, let's say an upstream binding site. And suppose, let's say that they have found that, and these are numbers that I stole from someplace, so presumably they have some meaning, and they're representative of something. Okay? But one of the more important binding sites is a sort of Tata box, okay, T-A-T-A. That is upstream of lots of genes. And what this sort of shows is that when they aligned a certain number of genes to find sort of this motif, this sort of said that 79% of the time it started with a T, 95% of the time, the second character was an A. Most of the, the next character, T, was a little bit confused, but 44% of the time it became a T. The other character here was weakly conserved, but 60% of the time it was an A. 50% of the time there was an A, and 96% of the time there was a T. So this is sort of representative of a sort of a description of one of these motifs. It sort of shows how noisy it might be. It sort of seems that the T in the last position is highly conserved, the T in the first position, and the A in the second position is pretty important. The next three positions have a lot more variation, okay? And by taking a look at a lot of observed sequences where you see this motif, okay, by describing them in terms of probabilities, you capture this sort of noisy data, okay, the noisy nature of the motif. The motif you often hear described is just TA, TA, T, you know, TA, TA, AT would be the majority position at each one of these faces. The profile gives you more accurate information. The profile is a matrix of probabilities. Okay? And this sort of captures, again, what you would like to see. In a perfectly strong, conserved motif, the probability would be 1 that each position has an associated character with it. If the character is, if you get 1/4 of the bases with each composition, okay, at each position you get 1/4 of the bases as possibilities, you have a useless motif, okay, because that's just the same as random. Okay? Any questions? One way when you go to see these talks, okay, again, I don't know if this picture shows up great, but one thing that I use, that occasionally at these talks you see when biologists will talk about how strong a motif they found, they will give you these pictures that, this one didn't reproduce so well, but it's really neat, where at each position they will have a letter, the size of the letter, they'll have the letter A, C, G, and T with the size of the letter corresponding to what is the probability that it occurred at that position. So if you see all written in big letters, you see strongly conserved parts. And if you see a couple of half letters, then you know it's more weakly conserved. Okay? Basically, what this is just a graphic way of encoding the profile matrix. So what do you study to get this profile? We'll talk about it a little bit later. But basically, the idea would be, suppose you have a line. Once you, let's say, are convinced that there is this motif, that in fact CA, CA, AAT is an important thing that is common to a lot of genes, maybe you go and you find 100 genes that have it in its upstream reading. You know, more or less have this motif in its upstream reading, you know, frame. You know, its upstream region. More or less have this sequence. So the motif, once I know the motif, once someone tells me T-A-T-A-A-T is the motif, then it's certainly reasonable I go to a lot of genes and say, gee, do I almost see that motif in the upstream region? And then once I find the best match for this motif, I can then compute those kind of statistics from that. Okay? What makes me think that this is important? Okay, well now you're getting into a reason of why it is hard to tell.
There are different genes which have different motifs. I mean, maybe you can plug them together.
Right. So for example, what it is that there are certain motifs that appear in a large number of genes. Okay, so I think that the tablet box is maybe the most famous example. This is something that biologists looking at the first few hundred gene sequences said, hey, there seems to be this TADA thing about 35 bases upstream from the gene. Maybe that's important. Okay, and then when you start clustering them together, then you say, yeah, you know, well, look, it's not always here. You know, in fact, mostly it's the, in fact, it's actually not the TATA that's important. It's the TAT. This downstream T was more important. Okay? But that's, so initially it was presumably done by eyeballing and asking what sort of consensus patterns were common. But you should realize that the ease of finding these things depends upon how strongly they're conserved and how often they occur. You know, that much should be clear. And the reason why, so if every gene always had a pattern like this, 35 bases upstream, then you would probably notice it and you would be able to build such a table. But if you have a binding site that's shared by only, let's say, 20 genes with similar noisiness, it's a lot harder to find. And that's why not all binding sites have been found yet, because many of them seem to be, you can't identify it purely in a random way by just looking, you know, in an arbitrary way by looking at the patterns. Okay? Any questions? Okay. And so basically, when the motif is somehow a concise representation, I would say that the motif is this, the profile is this, although people probably use the terms interchangeably. Yes? Okay, so the question here is, you would like to say, gee, if I really want to understand how this gene is turned on, why is it enough to know the motif? Why do I really want to know who its partner is, who's kissing it? Okay? Well, the short answer is that, of course, you want to know this and this, okay? But we don't know everything at first. At first, we start getting these DNA sequences. And it's not that hard to sort of make conjectures about what might be motifs. It's something a computer scientist can do. Okay, so this is something that's not somehow so hard or so risky, and it's something that you can make guesses about. Now then, the question of what proteins bind to this is also interesting, but in fact much easier to identify once you have candidate motifs. So there are now various assays, various experiments you can do, where they have basically taken DNA sequences and candidate proteins and measured what's the likelihood that this protein sticks to this pattern. So there is a certain amount of experimental evidence that says what proteins like to bind to what patterns. Okay? But to a certain extent, that these finding these motifs is sort of the first step of what are the interesting patterns you should be trying. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So what can you do once you have these motifs and profiles?
Well, there are things you can do with it.
One thing that you can do with it is, a lot of the protein databases. I told you that somehow the interesting, that there's been a lot of work in taking all the proteins from different species and sequences and trying to order them and cluster them into groups that are somehow very similar. And if you look at the major protein databases, like SwissProt, which we'll hear more about actually in a week or so, they are organized around motifs. Okay, and these motifs are sort of these highly conserved patterns that occur in the protein. And why might that be useful? Well, now suppose I sequence a new protein. Okay, I do a gene prediction, a gene recognition. Okay. I now want to try to figure out, I've had this gene, I now think I have a new protein candidate. I want to figure out what that protein does. If there is this little motif description of what a protein is, family is, I would want to align, test my new protein against all the known motifs and see whether it falls into one of these classes. Okay? So comparing a protein against a motif is a way of identifying sort of what group is it in and what does it do. And comparing against a motif is a much simpler job, if you think, than comparing it against all the proteins in the database. Why? You've got thousands of proteins in the database. You presumably have a few hundred or so motifs that have been identified. But these motifs are very, very short. It's relatively easy to compare against that. Okay? Any questions? So that would be one reason why. Okay? So how could you test whether or not a protein, a new protein or a new DNA sequence, what motifs are in it? Well, it should be pretty easy. Okay? if we were just comparing against and doing an exact search for a motif, you know, that would be simply a question of exact string, substring matching in a sequence, or even noisy, you know, approximate string matching. You want to say, hey, where does it occur with at most two mistakes? And that's the kind of thing you could do with dynamic programming, just given the motif. And given that one of the patterns is extremely short, this is efficient. If you want to, if you have a profile, on the other hand, it's also easy to measure the significance of a motif by simply aligning it against every possible window of that length in the unknown protein or sequence, and multiplying the probabilities together, and comparing that to, you know, sort of, you know, the maximum likelihood occurrence of the motif would be T, you know, there'd be a 0.98 chance that there's a T here, a 0.9 chance that there's an A there. By multiplying those probabilities together, we can get an idea as to how likely or unlikely it matches that motif. And if it's above a certain score, we take it as a hit. Any questions? Okay, so that should be pretty clear. And again, there are, you know, if in the case where the motif or profile has, you know, gaps in it, then you have to do dynamic programming and you have to have our models for it. But basically, it should be clear that given that these motifs are short descriptions of potentially interesting patterns, and that it should be fairly easy to search a string to see whether it has one of these. Any questions? Finding it, trying to identify a statistically interesting motif, is a more difficult problem. Any questions? Okay. So how do you identify motifs? And the standard way to do it, okay, or the maybe the most reliable way to do it, well, that's a standard way to do it, would be by doing a multiple sequence alignment. We've talked about pairwise sequence alignment, okay, and we talked about homology search. That was the idea that we're going to take two strings and identify, you know, do a substitute when they were the matching characters, or deletions or insertions. In a multiple sequence alignment, we may have many strings, 10, 20, 100, okay? And what we would like to do is to sort of somehow align those strings so that consensus patterns become apparent. And this is a diagram. This particular sequence I have is a diagram I got from the web, okay? So I don't know exactly what these proteins involved. It tells you what the proteins are. These are various, you know, this is a particular protein in a bunch of different viral species in human and stuff like this. And this is what the author of the diagram thought was an interesting consensus. If you look at it, I think you can read it from here. Here, it decided that that this consisted of two conserved regions, where on this side, the first one was scored a G, because out of how many sequences are there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. How many of them had Gs? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 of the 10 had a G. And that was enough to satisfy the person that that was a G. Okay? Here in the first character here, we had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 A's, but that somehow was not enough to convince the person involved that that was a interesting part of the motif. So the motif that this person that this researcher took out of this alignment was that it was a GGTACA followed by three bases that we don't care about, followed by TGTTCT. Okay. And this, to me, sort of captures a little bit of why finding motifs that would be interesting, or consensus sequences, should be hard. This is a very subtle feature that you're trying to identify. And, you know, why, you know, it's not obvious to me why you decide to make a call for 6 in agreement, but not for 5 in agreement. Okay? But again, what you're trying to do is to identify regions that are conserved in evolution. Okay, and so you need to sort of have some notion of statistical significance to say that this is significant, whereas the other alignments are not. Any questions? Now, with multiple sequence alignment, so multiple sequence alignment is one of the things that biologists do a lot of. Okay, this is very important, okay, to try to identify the protein motifs or the DNA binding motifs. We've also seen multiple sequence alignment in a much, what I would say, weaker way. At the beginning of the semester, we talked about fragment assembly. When we were doing fragment assembly, as you will remember, we had these overlaps. We identified overlap sequences. And that once we'd identified the overlaps, then we had put the fragments together. Ultimately, at the end, we wanted to identify a single DNA sequence corresponding to what was, that particular piece of DNA. And so the decision had to be made to vote among all of these, there had to be some kind of an alignment of these sequences, okay, in a world where there might have been, let's say, a gap, a base missing, or a base might be missing, or repeated, or a substituted wrong. To try to find the optimal consensus was important, because the consensus of that multiple sequence alignment was what we returned as the final finished sequence. So in sequence assembly, there is multiple sequence alignment. That is relatively simple, because presumably these sequences are very, very similar to each other. Much trickier is the case of multiple sequence alignment, where we have, sequences that have diverged a lot by evolution. Any questions? So, for example, here is, again, something else I stole from the web at one point, about a program for doing multiple sequence alignment, where it did, on this particular set of sequences, okay, there were two different kinds of alignments done. One was a heuristic alignment, okay, and maybe agree that the heuristic is unimportant. One was, by their measure, the optimal alignment, okay, which presumably was a lot harder to compute. The thing that's interesting to me is to notice how far apart these alignments are, okay, that trying to make sense of, these are sequences, these are proteins that are in principle supposed to align, okay, these conserved regions are supposed to tell you that they align. One reason they may align, these are obviously proteins, these are in the amino acid alphabet. You may get points for how similar the two amino acids are, okay? But this sort of shows how noisy a problem multiple sequence alignment is in realistic situations, okay? Does everybody sort of see that you're not seeing any column with all A's in it, or all C's or G's or anything like that, okay? Any questions? Okay? Very good. So the question now is, how do we do, once we did, found one of these alignments of strings, then maybe any highly conserved region might be a motif. The question that we're interested in is, how do you do these multiple sequence alignments? Okay? Now, the first idea for algorithms for doing multiple sequence alignments would be to generalize our two-dimensional alignment to three or more sequences. So pairwise sequence alignment was pretty easy. We sort of saw that we did that with dynamic programming. We basically built up a recurrence relation, which said that the optimal way of aligning the prefix, the first I characters of sequence A with the first J characters of sequence B, okay, was this. And then we figured out how to compute that in terms of other, basically smaller aligned sequences. We could do a similar thing if we have a three-dimensional alignment, where instead of building up a table, a sort of a matrix or a two-dimensional array of states, we could have a three-dimensional matrix where cell ijk denotes the cost of the match of the first I characters of one sequence, the first J characters of the other, and the first K characters of the next. And in a straightforward way, you can generalize dynamic programming so that basically the matrix is now going to have, if you have K sequences, instead of having N squared, you're going to have N to the K cells in the matrix. Any questions? But the basic machinery should be the same. We're still doing dynamic programming. We're still filling up each cell based on the values of previous cells. The cost of the cell being the optimal alignment, the cost of the optimal alignment to this point, and the optimal alignment between the three is ultimately going to be a walk through that matrix.
Okay. Any questions?
So what is the cost of such an alignment, though, in dynamic programming? We agree that there are N to the K cells in the dynamic program, because there's for every prefix of each sequence, that is a state in the matrix. The cost of doing the update grows of the form 2 to the K times N to the K. Why is this? How many cells does to generalize the sequence, the recurrence relations that we use for string matching, how many cells does it depend on to update that cost?
Okay. When we were doing two-dimensional alignment, how many cells did each string appear in? Forget about gaps. How many cells did each sequence depend on? Three. Okay. Basically, it involved that we were deleting one from one of them, from sequence one from sequence two, or basically changing both dimensions. What would it be if we had a three-dimensional alignment? Okay? Basically seven of them. Okay? That we're going to be basically, what would be the cost here? Either we could sort of pay the cost of aligning all of them. Say there were three of them, so sequence A, B, and C. The direction we could go from was diagonally across the matrix, so where we advanced all three pointers. Or we might be advancing from a place where we advanced two pointers, meaning this was a substitute. Or we might be mapping where we align only one such thing. So there are basically 2 to the k minus 1 subsets of non-empty things that we're imagining. Okay? And the optimal choice to go to fill the cell depends on taking the best of all those possibilities. So the complexity here
is going to be something like 2 to the k times n to the k to optimize a particular, do this by dynamic programming. Any questions? So how bad is this? Okay, well, it depends what K is and what N is. If N is, you know, if N is 100, is 100 cubed times 8 unreasonable? The answer is probably not. You could do three sequences of size 100. But you would have, it would be hopeless to do, okay, 100, 10 sequences of size 100. Okay? And so doing this dynamic programming gets complicated. The complexity grows rapidly with the number of sequences. Any questions? And it grows even faster if you start worrying about gaps also. Okay? So doing multiple alignments by dynamic programming is a tricky business. Okay? For small sequences, you can do it. For long sequences, you can't. Any questions? That should be clear. Now, there's an even more subtle point, though, about multiple alignment that we haven't really covered. It's the question of what is the right score function for a multiple alignment. Okay, so let's look back at one of these pictures here. If you look at this thing, when we were comparing with an alignment in two dimensions, we had, here we have substitutions. We paid a price for that. We have insertions, those represented here. We also have pairs of things that are both insertions, okay, or deletions if you wish, okay, these gap type things. And we're paying them across more than one sequence. So the question of how you score one of these things is not quite as obvious. It's no longer, obviously, the number of insertions and deletions you need to convert one to the other, because you have a set of things that you're converting all to the other. So identifying what the scoring criteria is for how good an alignment is a little bit of a tricky business. And there are lots of different measures that have been developed for the quality of an alignment. Okay? One way to measure the quality of an alignment, they call an entropy method, would be to take a look at each column in one of these alignments and to see what the probability distribution is of symbols in that alignment, in that column. If this alignment is a good thing, we would expect that all the bases would be very similar. And so we would have a very, very skewed distribution here. Okay? That somehow the information content of that column is higher than just a random, is different than it would be from a random sequence. That there was, in some sense, well, in an information sense, theoretic, less information, but that if the distribution of symbols was more skewed than you would expect by chance, that's a good thing, and you should get some points for that. So one way to do it would be to base on the probability distribution. Another would be based on what you would call tree alignment metrics. Suppose you know something about these two sequences. Let's say this is human, this is gorilla, this is bacteria, this is, yeast, and this is virus, okay? So you've got the case that the virus is quite far, this is fairly closely related to this, and this is fairly closely related to this, but this is further related than that. If you know something about the origin of the species, okay, and where the sequences are and how similar the alignment should be, you could factor that into your evaluation function, okay, and give you points for, that the things that should be very similar, differences there might be more heavily penalized than in the alignment between things that are supposed to be far apart, okay? Probably the most important, the one that you see in the literature the most, is something they call the sum of pairs metric, where what you will do is, for each column, if there are k sequences, there are k-choose-2 pairs of symbols in that column. Namely, if you pick any pair of sequences in any column, there's going to be two symbols there. And now we can assign them the cost of substitution, or insert or delete, and add that up over all pairs, over all characters in the positions in the alignment. And that would be the sum of pairs cost for a multiple alignment. Any questions? So, just to clarify that. For this particular column here, let's look for a column here. Here was a nicely conserved column, okay? There's 4 G's and 1 A. So that you get 4 choose 2, the cost that you would get would be 4 choose 2 times the cost of substituting a G with an A, plus 4 times the cost of substituting an four choose 2 times the cost of substituting a G with a J, plus 4 times the cost of substituting a G with an A. Okay, and you would make such a computation over all pairs, and that would be the cost of the alignment. Any questions? The advantage of doing sum of pairs cost is actually kind of interesting, that it means that you can sort of reduce a multiple alignment, the cost of a multiple alignment can be reduced to the cost of all pairs of pairwise alignments you get. So if you want to compute the sum of pairs cost, one way to do it would be to compute over each column the sum of each pairs. The other possibility is that you take for every pair of alignments, you compute their cost in isolation. And provided you don't charge for replacing an indel with an indel, the costs you get are the same. So it gives you a way to think about a multiple alignment as in terms of all pairs of pairwise alignments. And that's why that's kind of a commonly used way to think about it. Any questions? Okay. Okay. So any ideas how you might be able to compute multiple sequence alignments? Okay, we agree dynamic programming is costly. In fact, under the sum of pairs criteria, finding the optimal multiple alignment of sequences is an NP-complete problem. So for large enough problems, you cannot compute the optimal alignment in polynomial time. Can anybody suggest any heuristics or ideas for how you might align multiple sequences? In the absence of, now we realize we can't do it exactly. Can anybody suggest some approaches to multiple sequence alignment that might seem reasonable? Yeah. Okay, now you're suggesting a way to suggest align motifs, to find motifs. Motifs, though, remember, are small, highly conserved sequences. Here I've sort of drifted a little bit into discussing the alignment of potentially long sequences, like entire proteins. So somehow I would argue that you would be, once you have a multiple alignment, you can find the motifs. But, so you, one way you might be to look for a very, look for the motifs first and use them to anchor things. Okay? That might be one way to do it. Okay?
So what are you planning to do with EMA? Do you want to have small things, some kind of motif finding all these?
So I've sort of drifted a little bit between motif finding as an application of multiple sequence alignment. In general, the problem is given long sequences, a lot of long sequences try to align them so that you get a globally good alignment. Okay. Any other? Yeah.
Two first
line. So one heuristic that I might try, okay, that would come to me if I was given a multiple sequence alignment problem, is to try to align sequences in pairs, okay, or to try to start aligning, since pairwise alignment I'm good at, okay, how can I exploit pairwise alignment to align these things? So what might I do? One algorithm might be to try to take, just pick two random sequences, arbitrary sequences, align them, and then one by one pick a random sequence to stick into that, and now align the next sequence with my align sequence. Is that it? Okay, so that general class of heuristics sounds like a reasonable thing. But how should I pick my sequences to try to do with that kind of a pairwise alignment? So you're saying you want me to try all k choose 2 pairs, and well, why not? It seems like a reasonable thing. And pay n squared time for that. And then pick which two to align. Maybe the ones that seem most similar. Why? Because I think my way of thinking is I'm probably doing the least amount of damage in picking them to be in my align, to be aligned. Okay? And so you can imagine that there are a bunch of heuristics. Okay, of the form that work by basically exploiting pairwise alignments. Okay, and these heuristics basically work by joining basically merging pairs of sequences. Okay, or merging sequences, aligning sequences in groups, and then slowly merging them. So what's interesting is that any multiple sequence alignment of this type takes on the flavor of a tree. Where the leaf nodes are individual sequences. And the intermediate nodes are the result you get by merging these two alignments, by aligning these two sequences. Or in the case of deeply internal nodes, aligning two alignments, which is conceptually very similar. It's just a string of that alphabet also having some indels in there. And so a bunch of the heuristics for multiple sequence alignment work in this basic way,
and they would vary according to exactly what is their cost measure, and how do you make the ones for doing, the sequences for doing alignment. One possibility is that you constantly do a greedy type thing, where you pick the two most similar sequences and keep merging them. That's what would be suggested here. Another might be that we always insist that the topology be a binary tree, a complete binary tree, and do the merging like this. Another possibility might be we always insist that we add one new sequence per merging. My sense would be this would be a bad way to do the alignment, because any mistakes you introduce at the lower level will propagate all the way up to the top, okay? Clearly you want in principle there to be sort of a short tree, okay? Fairly shallow tree, because that way any mistake doesn't sort of propagate too far. It doesn't affect too many of your future alignments, okay? And in principle, we seem to think that it'd be better to align similar strings before we align more complicated, more varying strings. But again, all of this is now basically in the realm of heuristics.
Okay? So that's basically the way I would say most of the multiple, yeah, question. There are various results that for certain of these heuristic algorithms, sort of approximation results. Remember that we said that the problem of computing the optimal multiple sequence alignment under many criteria like sum of pairs, okay, is NP complete. For something like the sum of pairs alignment, there are approximation algorithms that will guarantee you that your sum of pairs score is within a factor of 2 or something like that of optimal. Okay? So that's good. On the other hand, if you look at this thing, it's not clear to me how much, the heuristic alignment looks bad. The optimal alignment to me also looks bad. Okay, but they're quite different. And so in trying to get the meaning between these alignments, multiple sequence alignment is a messy area. It's an area I've never worked in, I've always been afraid of. This is a very messy kind of business. Okay, because, trying to figure out what the right alignment is not clearly defined. It's not clear that any one of these measures is the right alignment. Okay? The bottom line is there are some provable algorithms, but I think the most popular programs probably work by, for small enough examples, doing branch and bound or some kind of a heuristic, some kind of a provable heuristic to give you an optimal alignment. And for larger alignments, we'll do something along the merging kind of things that we talk about. Question? I see. So one question. So the question of how you want to measure the quality of the solution, the Pine metric seems to be you want to hear a consensus sequence that maximizes the amount of agreement, let's say the number of faces that agree between what you call and how you align it. That is presumably equally hard to do. Or maybe, in fact, that can maybe a special case of pairwise alignment. Yeah. Okay. Well, it's certainly true that there is no particular guarantee that in the aligned weird things might happen in the consensus alignment. It probably is not the case that you'll make a base call that does not appear in any of the resulting sequences. But bottom line is it's a messy area. It's a question of getting your criteria, sum of pairs or whatever you want, right, and also your substitution costs right. and hoping that what you have shows up the structure that you want. Yeah.
Isn't that obvious, like, finding the optimal one, we define as the one which, like, any random
So Sal, what you really want, the optimal alignment is the one that the biologist is most happy with. That is in principle that. But that, of course, is not a quantifiable objective. Yeah. So probably what you want as an alignment, it would be the right alignments are the ones that probably show the strongly conserved regions as being matched and don't really care so much about the other things. Well, it might, again, it's hard to say whether you want it to be the case that in the optimal alignment, that in the strongly conserved part, that it strongly matches all the strings. Maybe in a world where you collected 100, you know, your 100 proteins that you think are similar, maybe one got in there by mistake. So you don't want to penalize yourself too much for having an alignment where some protein doesn't score very highly against it. Again, it's clear that there's these kind of criteria come in, and that you're now talking about a relatively, you know, noisy, you know, a somewhat rough game that you're playing here. But what you really want to come out of the alignment is the strongly conserved regions sort of come out, okay? And that's what you're sort of hoping will come out with one of these alignments. Any questions? Okay. And again, when you go to talks by biologists, you'll quite often see them flash up a multiple alignment. They will have colors in certain columns where they think they saw enough consensus to make them happy. Okay? And that's usually how, at least my interpretation of how these things are ultimately done. Any questions? Okay. So that is the basic question of multiple sequence alignment. Okay? It should be clear that you know, we have a couple of ways in mind where you can do it. It should be clear it's an important job, and that it is a way to do motif finding. Any questions? Okay, good. So, again, I've mentioned these, I sort of intertwined these two topics, and I hope I haven't confused people. Motif finding is really this notion of trying to find these short, small, well-defined regions. Multiple sequence alignment is, in general, aligning big things together. Yeah. Okay, so what you're saying is, again, there are problems that might come up when you do one of these multiple alignments. Again, in messy business, it is not necessarily the case. What you're concerned with is CAT might be the motif, but the cat might have wandered over here in a different multiple alignment. And here you may have a Q, you know, a GTA or something like that. So in the optimal multiple alignment, you're not by any means guaranteed that the motif is going to necessarily be conserved. But in the quote-unquote right multiple alignment, the one that the biologist would like to see, the highly conserved regions will all be aligned. Okay? And, you know, that's what you would like to have happen. There's no guarantee it will happen. But on the other hand, when you do an alignment, you look here and you say, hey, 90% of these guys had a C here, 70% of them had an A here, and 80% of them had a T here. Maybe that's an interesting region. So now maybe I'll consider the cat motif, okay, and then look at all my sequences to see if I have that. Okay? So it should be clear that if I do a multiple alignment and I see anything that stares out at me, that is quite likely a motif. That much you should believe. But again, in general, motif finding, especially very subtle motif finding, will not necessarily come out of doing multiple alignments. Okay? Motif finding is a very complicated problem because we're looking for very short, very weakly conserved patterns. So one rigorous definition of a motif, if you want an algorithmic definition of a motif, you might say that a string M is a L, D motif if you have a, it is a string of M, is a string of length L, such that each of your input sets contains a substring of length L, which is at most D base changes away from M. Okay? So this now will decouple sort of the problem of motif identification from multiple alignment. Okay, yeah. The motif finding programs I look at in general, at least the ones that I've been reading about lately, are seem to not look for short patterns and not worrying about insertions and deletions. It seems like in general the positions in the motif seem to make a difference. You don't tend to have insertions or deletions. And I think the reason for that is,
if you think of a motif as a binding site, okay, you imagine that you've got this hook that's going to bind right there, and a T and an A. Something is going to bind to it. Okay, in order to bind these separate things, you probably need to have the same number of bases to keep them equally far apart. Okay, so in general, the motifs that people look at least these shortly conserved patterns, you don't really worry so much about the deletions in. It's hard enough to find them without looking for deletions. And in an application like this, you can convince yourself that if there are things that don't matter, they likely don't matter for a certain number of bases. So it's not like it's from 1 to 3 here. It's likely 3 things that don't matter. Any questions? So just to give you an idea again how hard the motif finding problems are, okay? Again, our basic problem we would like to say is, given a set of sequences, I'd like to find a motif. Is there an LD motif in that sequence? Namely, a string of length L, such that every one of the input sequences contains a string of length L that's at most a distance D from our motif. Okay? Now, if D was 0, if we were looking for an exact string of length L that occurred in all of those strings, this should then be fairly easy to do. Okay, we could build a suffix tree. You could build a suffix tree. There are a lot of different ways you could do this. But if you were not allowed any errors, one thing you could do is try all windows of size L in one of the strings. And for each one of these windows, say, these Elmers, are you in this, 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 and this? It would reduce to exact string matching. And it should be clear that if D is 0, if there is no variation in any of the bases, it's easy to identify such motifs. But D is not 0. There is going to be a lot of noise here. Okay? If D was very, very, very small, and L was relatively large, you might hope that there would be a long common string in a lot of these motifs. So you're now looking for this, this unknown motif. Okay, if the motif was relatively long, and there were a relatively small number of deviations from that, you would expect that maybe there is a reasonably long substring that exactly occurs in all of these, and maybe you could hit on that exact substring. Okay? But if you have a lot of errors in a short motif, you're not going to find such things. Okay? So searching for a common exact substring is not going to work once D gets relatively large relative to L. Does everybody sort of agree with that? Does that match intuition? Now, if L is very short, one way to find motifs, let's say you wanted to test if there are all possible DNA motifs of size 6. I think that there's a motif out there that's a 6 mer of DNA. Well, 4 to the 6 is not that large. It's what? 4 to the 6 is? Somebody would do more. 4,000. Okay, 4,000 is nothing. Okay, why not try all possible 4,000, 6 mers? Or 7 mers, or 8 mers? Okay? And you can, for every one of them, where is the closest match in all of my input strings? And if it's good enough, I could identify,
Once I find a close match in every string, I know I could find such a thing. The problem is that the motifs that you're looking for that are hard are just long enough that they are, you can't do an exhaustive search for them, but short enough that you can't rely on their length for sort of long common substrings, the way we did when we did fragment overlap. Remember when we did overlap for sequence assembly? We were relying on the fact that we could find long sequences in common. Okay? Okay? The other problem that comes up in searching for motifs is that if D is sufficiently large, if you're asking G, are there any strings of length 15 such that they differ, that they have a match with at most 10 substitutions in each one of the input strings, the answer is going to be yes. Okay? Whether or not, you know, it's just not statistically interesting. If D is large enough relative to S, you're allowing yourself enough freedom that there is almost certainly going to be such a motif. And in fact, many such motifs. Okay? So somehow, what we're interested in are cases where, D is low enough to not occur many times by chance, yet high enough that you can recognize, somebody give yourself some slack to allow for, sort of evolution and base changes and things like that. So examples of hard motif problems are trying to find, is there in my target set of sequences a 15 mer that differs in at most 4 positions among every base, in every sequence, or an 18 mer that differs in at most 6 positions. These are sort of rare enough to be interesting, but still hard to find. Okay? Any questions? So how do you do, how do you do motif finding in this kind of an environment? Okay? One way that you do it, okay, again, is by building a hidden Markov model. Okay? You could, for example, take a bunch of sequences. You could kind of train them to say, is there a way to align my sequence where my model is going to be spin my wheels for a while, then back a short motif, and then spin your wheels for a while? You could imagine training on this to figure out what the transition probabilities here are. And this could be your motif. Okay, so that's sort of a great principle that's not any different than what we've been doing so far. Okay? And then building this sort of short-hit Markov model would be a way to find some motifs. How well does it do? Well, depends upon your training set, blah, blah, blah. Okay? Another method that people use that when you talk about motif finding, you hear a lot of, are people talking about what they call Gibbs samplers. Okay? And, a Gibbs sampler is, again, sort of a heuristic, simulated annealing-y-like kind of an idea, where what they do is, you start out with, let's say you want to try to find a motif in a set of 100 sequences. Maybe you randomly align them at first, okay, and just somehow say, yes, this is my interesting part of my motif. This is how all the sequences match my motif. Then what you do is randomly delete one of the sequences from your motif, from your alignment, and then realign it so that it matches as close as possible the profile that you have in your current alignment. Okay? So somehow the sequence was originally part of your alignment, but it may have been stuck in it, originally was put in there randomly, it doesn't have any meaning. Now when you pull it out, you insert it again, where it more closely matches the current profile. And now again, it's another sequence, you pull it out at random. And you say, where if I align that against the current profile, where does that match best? And the hope would be that, and in practice this seems to work reasonably well, when you go through enough iterations of this kind of a thing, maybe what you converge on fairly reliably is some kind of a motif. So you hear this word Gibbs sampler a lot. Okay? Gibbs is, I think, Gibbs sampling is sort of a physics type term, right? So there isn't, Mr. Gibbs did not do anything with motif finding in particular, but the statistics, you know, sort of these kind of statistical mechanics type of things are what people thought about by Gibbs sampling. So this is saying in the paper I have an opportunity, and I'm just looking for one motif.
You're saying, what if I want to find more than one motif in these upstream sequences? Well, once you find one, maybe you delete them. You delete it, you can repeat the search again with what's left. Okay? So if it's hard to find one, it's hard to find two. Okay? It's harder to find two. Okay? But you can play these kind of games. So, you know, once you establish one motif, then you can mask it and look for other ones. Any questions? Okay?
Now this is an area, again, I'll finish up now. This is an area where, in fact, the algorithms have been getting quite a bit better in recent years, okay? And one of the ideas that is working fairly well for identifying very subtle motifs is actually something that Nanda mentioned earlier, actually, when we were asking about ideas for things. One idea might be as follows.
Suppose I were to say, okay, I'm looking for a motif. Suppose I pack. Let's say I'm looking for a motif of size L. Now there's going to be a certain amount of these are strings of strings of size L. I can't do an exact match, expect exact similarity between strings of size L, because this is too noisy a matter. But I can hope for maybe exact matches among a lot of things if I pick a much smaller value. Let's say I'm looking for a motif of size 50. Suppose I half every 15 mark based on a particular subset of bases. Let's say the fourth, 7/13, the second, fourth, 13th, and 15th base in that 15 mark. Now it might be the case that if there is a motif, it is more likely that those 15 that those four bases will be identical than if they were not in a motif. So suppose I now build a hash table where I hash them on a random subset of characters. So I have each 15 and I slide along using only a particular subset of characters. Any bucket that has more numbers than it should quite possibly means that the elements in there, all share all characters in that position. Quite possibly those sequences have a motif around that area. Okay, and it enables me to focus my search on the bins in the hash table that are high. Okay, if I do enough random subsets, maybe I will get lucky and find the motif that way. And again, if you quantify the probabilities right, you can determine how many do I need to reduce my luck chance, the probability that I get it, make that high enough to make it interesting. Okay, and with these kind of an arguments, there are now
reasonably good programs that predict motifs at reasonably high thresholds. Any questions? Okay. Thanks for your attention. Next class, we're going to talk about, again, with sort of continuing sections on sort of the study of proteins. Next time, we're going to look a little bit more at protein docking and things like that, and continue with proteins till Thanksgiving. Any questions? Thank you.
Oh, okay. Right. No.